Let's keep going.
Hey, you're now listening to Taking It Down, and we are the pop culture discussion podcast from the Alabama Take. I'm your host and editor-in-chief of the website, Blaine Duncan. Joining me any minute now will be my comrades, Adam Morrow and Donovan Reinwald. And we're all set to be talking about our very first book club segment with the book, The Only Good Indians, by author Stephen Graham Jones. Plus, we'll converse all about the Amazon release of the new Borat movie, so brace yourselves. Hey, Adam. Hey, Donovan.
Good to be here yet again.
Not.
Just serve it up and let him spike it there.
Yes.
it's been a long week for wives everywhere.
It really has been.
My poor spouse as
my spouse.
I tried to avoid that one. She has laid the divorce papers on the table. I just haven't signed
yours. Yours too.
Do you get a group discount on that?
She did. She just says I have a glint in my eye now. Stay the hell away from me.
Hope has returned. let it exercise itself before you come back around.
That glint is not COVID. Have you been checked?
Can you catch COVID through your beehole?
Mm-hmm.
Then yes, I have been checked.
Actually, didn't they recommend? Wasn't there like some New York guidelines that said do it in the beehole or do it from behind because that would help you not breathe on each other?
I forgot about the health code. It was like the Department of Public Health. Like guidelines.
Yeah, do it from behind, put a sheet between you or something. It was something very
it was the University of Georgia actually had health guidelines that they sent out to students about not only safe practices but also safe practices during the pandemic. COVID.
You gotta put a mask on it.
That's our COVID talk. Short and sweet. I have a question for you guys, because I think you can answer yes to these. Have you guys had a chance to listen to the new Springsteen or the new Jeff Tweedy? And if so, do you have a tweet length review for either one? And I got some thoughts, but I'll wait.
Springsteen tweet length review is, why the hell was Letter to You the single?
God, thank you. All right. That's exactly where I'm going to go with my thoughts. Adam, you, Jeff Tweedy or Springsteen, either one?
I'll take the Tweedy. I've listened to his tweet length. Oh, boy.
tweet length-ish.
I thought it was very good. I think he has been so prolific the last few years that these are some of, and I appreciate that, but these are some of the better songs, I think, that he's put out as Tweedy or Jeff Tweedy. And I think hearing his production and hearing those floppy acoustic guitar strings and the dry drums and all that stuff, all that signature Tom Schick, Jeff Tweedy collaboration just makes me happy. It's like a warm hug. It is the Ted Lasso of musical tones. So I enjoyed it.
I've heard the few songs that were released early, and I like those.
I thought those were very strong. The three that he put out were great.
Yeah,
kind
I think
the opposite of the Springsteen.
I think you liked them better than I.
I think the boss should take notes on what you release and what you don't.
Well, I was surprised by Springsteen's album, and I'm glad it was getting rave reviews. I was surprised by those as well until I listened. That single Letter for You does, in fact, fit much better in the whole of the album, though it is the worst song. It's the weakest.
There needs to be a study about how good your records are and how bad you are at choosing your own singles.
I was going to say the Venn diagram there is nearly a circle.
Yeah, especially once you get out of like dominating the radio like he did back in the... I'm sure he could pick them back in the day, but now...
I don't know. Did he... He was probably like, oh, I want to release 10th Avenue Freeze Out. Someone had to like arm wrestle him to get Born to Run out there.
Probably.
Although 10th Avenue Freeze Out's great.
No, I'm not saying it's not a jam.
It's a very muscular album. I thought that was my adjective. It's good. And I've been listening to the song. I know it's an old song. He wrote it in the 70s, I think, but Janie Needs a Shooter.
That was a standout.
That's like one of his top songs in a long time.
I mean, 70, it's hard to top 70 Springsteen unless you're 80 Springsteen writing Nebraska.
And he comes in and Janie Needs a Shooter with that solid Promised Land kind of harmonica. Man, that's good.
Yeah, it's really robust sounding record, which, you know, when we were first talking about Letter to You, that was the thing that we all kind of agreed on. Like, it sounds good. There's energy. The single, I mean, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the single. And mm-hmm. I'd say every other song has that in spades, way more than... I just didn't like that song.
I didn't either. I still don't really, but it fits okay.
Yeah,
in the
I
album.
Mean, it's what, like the second or third track, and it's not super long either. It's fine. There's just a lot better stuff on that album.
Do we have any Quibi jokes left? Because
Quibi have any Quibi jokes left?
They have none. So it's up to us.
Blaine, every time I hear Quibi, I think when it had just been announced and it was all on paper and there were no commercials yet, you kept calling it Quibi.
Yeah, it's shuttering its doors. There's no more Quibi after a certain day or whatever. That's it.
My favorite bit with all this, it reports that Jeffrey Katzenberg told employees to listen to the song Get Back Up Again from the movie Trolls right after he told them they were all fired.
Oh,
not
is that
great.
True?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not a good look.
But it's kind of like, I've seen this bouncing around a couple places, but it's every time Quibi has announced a disaster, somebody is like, well, I remember being with like Katzenberg and he's like, in 10 years, every movie's going to be 3D. And somebody was like, even something like No Country for Old Men, he's like, every movie. So I think it's completely consistent with
this guy, man. He's out of touch.
He's like a dumb evil genius.
Well, no more Quibi. No more Cubies.
R.I.P. It's very, I mean, Halloween's coming up. How appropriate. It's going into the graveyard.
Hey, guys. Today's my birthday.
Today is the day?
Yeah, well, you know, we release on Tuesday. So if anyone's listening on Tuesday, today's my birthday.
But today isn't Tuesday. Usually your birthday is the future.
Donovan, we talk about it like it's Tuesday.
I'm talking.
Yeah, we record on Sunday. Shit. Everybody knows this. We have to go over this.
Wait, it's Sunday?
Sunday?
I'm sorry. I'm really hungover.
And for my birthday, Amazon Prime released a new Borat movie, which is gloriously titled Borat Subsequent Movie Film. And it has a lot of penetrations of the Trump regime. It is a mockumentary sequel. It's a whole lot like the first in that it features the brilliant, I will call him brilliant, Sacha Baron Cohen as the titular goofball reporter from Kazakhstan. In this one, Borat is making an attempt to bring his 15-year-old daughter to the U.S. as a bride for Vice Premier Mike Pence. And if that summary does not have you hooked to watch it, I can't help you. I can't go.
Can't be.
One caveat to that, he was initially bringing Johnny the Monkey.
Johnny the Monkey.
Yeah.
Not going so well.
I didn't quite catch what Johnny the Monkey was supposed to do once he got here.
Because he was the most beloved. He was the culture minister in Kazakhstan.
The little Sebastian of Kazakhstan, if you will.
Okay, I didn't know if he was supposed to fuck Mike Pence or Mike Pence was supposed to watch him fuck a man on a porno.
He can't even. He can't be around women
because he's such a hound.
America's most notorious hound, Michael Pence. I don't know why. It's one of those funny, it's kind of like, it's probably in the category of when everyone lost their dumb fucking minds and we're like, oh, we'll call him Drumpf. It's taking him down. But for some reason, them calling him McDonald Trump over and over again.
Yes.
My favorite joke. McDonald Trump.
That was your favorite joke? Okay.
Just like the repetition of that was great.
It really was. So tell me what your general thoughts were. We all enjoyed it, I guess, didn't we?
I think I did.
Yeah.
I was also, right, like I'm older now than the last one, so there were some points where I was appalled in different ways than I was the last time I saw it.
Go on.
What do you mean by that?
The racism, sexism, and misogyny seem a little like, I mean, it's just because of I'm older. We're all lived through the past 4 years. It seems scary, like scary in a really terrifying way now.
I don't know. The first movie seemed scary because it's like, oh, I know these people.
Well, absolutely. But also it's like, you know, we're going into the Obama era. Maybe things will get better, right? Like that one comes out in 2007. Now it looks like a prophecy. It is a prophecy.
It is. I thought the So Natalie hates watching people do things and not realize that they should be embarrassed for themselves. There's some German word for this that I always forget, but it's like secondhand embarrassment. Like, I will feel it for you.
Yes.
So she said it was tough to watch the first one, but now that we kind of know that there's a lot of really shitty people and they just own it on their own, like seeing them get had by Borat is not nearly as bad to watch, I guess.
Sometimes I was watching the film at some point and it's like, because he's very good at taking advantage of social conventions and kind of giving people, I'm like, what dumb thing would I say if I'm just going along, right? If I'm trying to sell my cage, right? This is my job. What dumb thing would I say? But he's so good at just like opening the door and letting someone walk right in, right? How many gypsies could I kill?
Well, he's good at that. Right. He starts with that, but then it just like spirals to where the guy's comfortable, like saying what he wants to say.
And that's the kind of thing I can watch all day. I can watch idiots hang themselves verbally all day.
I thought that that's the strength of his whole thing, right? And this one, where it fell a little flat to me was there was a lot more forced plot.
Absolutely.
There was a lot more scenes where it was just the two of them like trying to cook something up or whatever. And they had that in the first one, but not to the same degree. And maybe that's a product of like, it was self-aware in that people know who he is now. Like that was part of the joke, but so it's harder for him to do his thing, but I don't know, just not as funny.
He has the disguises are glorious in this one.
Yes, they are.
He's a hell of a dancer too. I'm just thinking about him dancing around the Texas State Fair in that disguise.
That was great. Him and Tutar.
I did appreciate that it didn't lean heavily on old joke repetition. It didn't try to bang out the greatest hits as much as you would have assumed.
That's true. Very true.
He only did the My Wife like twice, right? And he only did not
got plenty of high five.
Yeah, it did that one. So it had some classics, but it mixed some new stuff in, especially with the help of his daughter. I think that was a good move, because what this one allowed him to do was really take aim at sexism more so than he did in the first film. The first film was a wide array, and this one seemed much more pinpointed toward people who were anti-woman.
And I mean, everything about like, the joke is, right, like this poor ignorant backward country treats women like property, and then he just kind of lets everyone, you know, you can draw your own conclusions from watching the movie, right? But maybe America is not quite the wonderful place it thinks it is.
Yeah, I love to watch him skewer my least favorite people, sexist backward ass uneducated people who think they're intelligent because they have looked up a couple of conspiracy theories. When he houses with the two guys, I wondered how much that was set up. Throughout the film, I wondered how much that was set up. Like, how do you end up living with a guy and filming them and them not knowing something's up or that they're going to be roasted?
I mean, but we know from a while back that the sing-along is real. Because it got reported on.
Yes, that really happened and got a lot of people very angry.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Those people were the same ones saying, let's treat journalists like they do in
chop them
foreign
up
countries.
Like the Saudis do.
Yes. And they were into it.
That was the moment where I was like, oh man, like I know these people.
Adam, I have a question.
Okay, hit me.
You're at a U2 concert.
Uh-huh.
Just second row, general admission, living it up, and Bono starts doing a sing-along, and he says, cut them up like the Saudis do. Do you sing along?
Probably the first time, yeah.
at what point do you realize that
you know,
this
the
is...
doctor, the doctor comes to you with that little hammer and hits your knee, your leg's going to move, you know?
Okay, fair enough. At what point do you think
about it?
Wait, what I'm saying is incredibly against what I actually think and believe.
Hope never, right? You never.
I mean, you know, it's just a new verse of Friendly Bloody Sunday, right?
Yeah.
Toward the end of it.
You know, everybody says you get more conservative the older that you get. He's getting towards the end of middle age.
He could pull that one out. So what was the funniest moment, you guys? Other than McDonald Trump, that was a recurring one. Did you have a funniest scene for that you just loved?
I think the haircut.
God,
yes. The haircut was fantastic. How he kept clipping and showing it to him over and over.
That was great. Very good, sir.
So was that real? I got to know. Is that real? There's no way I would let a stranger cut my hair.
No, not with a pair of hedge clippers or, you know, shears for castrating bulls or whatever they were.
I did find the fax machine guy very funny. How he would have to read... How he would have to read the facts.
Well, that guy.
Is there any way that guy didn't know?
That guy.
He didn't.
I don't. That's what I'm asking. Like, it's so hard for me to believe that anybody in any corner of America would not recognize that figure.
I don't know if I have no idea. I don't know if my dad would know who Borat is.
Or someone like that. I have to say, I thought it was probably one of the most squirm-inducing ones, but the crisis pregnancy center bit was incredible.
Oh, it was great.
As was the father-daughter dance, if we're talking about the French moment. God, that was so funny.
I'm glad you called it the father-daughter dance, because I was going to call it the moon blood.
The debutante ball. Well, yeah, right? When he asks he asked that guy, how much do you think she's worth? $500. Like, what is wrong with these guys? Yeah.
So the movie ends with the idea that Borat was the one who spreads COVID-19. I did find, even though the movie was too plot heavy and less like the first in that way, in the first movie, I did enjoy that was part of a plot idea that they had. It was what a glorious idea to have Borat being the one who spreads COVID-19 to everyone.
Maybe a little pretty trickier good question. How do we feel about the synagogues? I would kind of want to know what the setup there was too. Cause I'm assuming, like, I don't think folks are usually just hanging out at the synagogue in the middle of the day.
Right. My assumption was that somebody in Sacha Baron Cohen's team asked if he could talk to some Holocaust survivors, and they've got a guy who had some questions about that. And then he comes in just like,
okay,
that's my guess. And yeah, that one, I think that joke is a little done.
It was terrifyingly heartwarming. The woman who said what she said. But also, yeah, it was kind of like, you know, Matt Zoller-Seitz in his review of it said, you know, is he inadvertently creating YouTube clips and memes that bigots can strip of irony and self-awareness and fold into the same old rancid propaganda? How responsible is Cohen for unintended consequences? I think that's a good question.
That's fair. But that could go to anything. You know, how...
Well, he says at the same time, these are the conundrums faced by critics who incarnate a phenomenon that they want to critique. So I thought that was a good... He gave this a 3.5-star review, by the way. So, you know, he certainly did not pan it. But it seemed like a good question to ask. You know, where is
now, don't
the
they
line?
Do 4 stars? 3.5 out of 4, right?
3.5 out of 4,
right,
yeah.
They don't even do 5 stars. So, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's a pretty good review. But I thought it was a good question to ask, too, because some of the scenes do kind of, you know, how, you know, as he put it, how much are you having your cake and eating it, too?
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm gonna squeeze this in here. Donovan, I'm going to tee you up, okay? I watched this movie with my wife.
Your wife.
Yeah, that's right. So I watched it with her, and she was getting a little tired at the end of the evening, and so... She says, I'm going to go ahead and go to bed, finish it up or whatever. She was, you know, kind of sort of into it. She enjoyed some of it. But she got up and left like 2 minutes before the Rudy Giuliani interview. And I was like, you missed the best part. Maybe one of the best parts.
What's the woman who plays Tutar? She was an amazing find. She's great.
And she actually is Eastern European.
I think she's from Bulgaria.
Maria Bakalova.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's great.
I thought that, so Alyssa Wilkinson from Vox wrote something about that, and her take was revealing about the Giuliani thing is perhaps more revealing than the incident itself is what the film points out through Bakalova's character. A certain womanly aesthetic appealing to a certain sort of man is prevalent enough that it can easily be exploited. This Fox News look that they had, which I thought was... super interesting kind of commentary.
I mean, somebody pointed out maybe the problem isn't that, because she didn't really, when they first announced like this could be problematic for Giuliani, was that she's a 15-year-old, right? And like he goes into the bedroom with her and like, sure, that's not great. But they didn't really present it that way in the movie.
No.
It was just, here's a foreign reporter who he's willing to get cozy with.
Here's a young like, right wing.
Right. Like all of his fellow Trumpians, you know, that are like inside the circle, if they haven't already been compromised, like how do you not learn your lesson at this point? If you're Giuliani, like to go do something stupid, like they're having drinks and let's go to the bedroom. It's like, why would you follow if you're a public figure?
Fantastic question, because I have no answer.
There is no answer. I mean, the same reason they agree to the interview is that they love attention.
I was going to say there's a real power to being flattered. And I mean, nobody is certainly immune from being flattered by the attentions of someone that you find attractive. And then, you know, if it's, you know, I thought that Alyssa Wilkinson's critique was so pointed, though. Like, they built his character to exactly be right at that weak point, right? To exactly appeal to a certain kind of man. And it doesn't say anything great about that man either.
There was apparently footage they didn't show of she made it into the White House.
Yeah.
And walked around the grounds. And I think she may have gone to a press conference. She shook Don Jr.'s hand at one point. She was in the same room as Trump and had not been, no security test or COVID test was administered. Which, I mean, we all know that that's what happens, but it's still just stunning. Pretty amazing. I will say when they're both at the conference, conservative conference, and he does his thing, I just the whole time thought the balls on this guy to actually do that. Yeah, I mean, it could have gone south. You talk about people who really don't, who have some hate in their heart. I wonder if you just wake up that day and you're like, I could get hurt or thrown in prison today.
The irony of that statement you just made is that hate in their heart, and it was the Christian
CPAC.
Yeah.
Boy, was there anything more chilling than to be watching this movie in October of 2020 and hearing like Mike Pence out there talking about COVID and how it's not a problem and how Donald and how we are prepared for it, and just to use the scientific term, the bullshit of that statement, you know?
Yeah.
It's just amazing. Terrifying.
I'm not used to hearing Pence speak at length about the wonders of Trump. Usually when he's speaking, it's about something specific based in government, right?
You don't see a lot of his stump speeches.
You got to seek those out.
No, you don't. And I don't think he's comfortable doing that. So it was interesting to see him say the specifics of the dear leader. So what comments do you think this movie makes on Americans? American culture or government or politicians? Do you have an opinion on that?
There was a great piece, I think it was in the New York Times, where they interviewed Sacha Baron Cohen and asked him about the differences in doing the movie this time versus during the Bush administration. And he said, during the Bush administration, it was really about how narcissistic Americans are, how unself-aware, blah, 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 the things that we know. So now it feels like he caught America at a moment where the total shift in people not covering these things up, being proud of being racist or being xenophobic or homophobic or whatever, misogynist, whatever, and just feeling like we're teetering on the edge of being a democracy in a way that Turkey is a democracy or even Russia is a democracy. That was from his mouth. I don't know what it said, how it presents to the viewer is a whole different thing. I don't know if Donovan wants to weigh in on that, but I don't know. Between him having to work in more plot, maybe because the character was recognizable, it just came off different, and it didn't feel like it cut quite as hard through the culture as the last one did. So it's a little bit harder for me to answer that question.
The first one, you know, it's kind of like lightning in a bottle, right? Like, he can't repeat the rodeo scene. He can't repeat. I liked the addition of Tutar. I thought she was great. Her art kind of gave the movie something to build around. And I mean, he does a good job of, you know, if it even is a joke, of so often just getting it from the horse's mouth, you know, getting people to say something that is really not too deep under the surface.
I think he did a really good job of that with, like, the cake.
That was astounding.
Yeah, it really, I mean, it was shocking getting her to do that, getting the plastic surgeon to use the terms that he did.
Amazing.
And then when she...
Yeah, it's. I'm sorry.
It was a funny thing.
The plastic surgeon saying titties over and over was just killing me.
Yeah, very funny. That's where you wonder at his, and I literally mean like a work of art, you wonder at it, his ability to get that guy to do that, like that quick back and forth that feels scripted, but he's just handling the comedic situation. Mm-hmm. He's a genius. But that scene and you said the rodeo scene from the first one, Donovan, the closest scene that I can think of is on a much smaller scale. It's where she goes into that Hampton Inn and the local chapter of like the Republican women are speaking. And you hear them kind of do their like we all know these women that talk in loving tones and kind of feign acceptance and let her speak and even encourage her and all these things. And then when she starts saying what she says... That took some stones, too, to get up there.
Absolutely.
And do that. But to see the women, like, the facade breaks, you know? Like, even visually, you can see it break into just, like, disdain on a lot of their faces. I thought that was really good. So it's picking at that seemed to be more prevalent this time, whereas last time it was like he could do man on the street interviews and they just made fools out of themselves.
Yeah, it had to be a lot more carefully managed, although... I have to admit, I was a fan of the footage they had of him just walking around, people recognizing him. That's not me. Oh, running into the street.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I think our final thoughts are a little plot heavy, but overall entertaining.
I think so.
Yeah.
You know,
overall
yeah.
Funny.
Entertaining almost, you know, how much rewatchability does this one have?
Hey, speaking of rewatchability, so I started the movie and there are a lot of subtitles at the beginning and mine were coming up in.
Wait, did yours come up in not quite German, but it looked German?
Absolutely. Did yours?
Yeah, mine did too. It was super weird. I had to turn subtitles off and set them to English.
That's exactly what I
at
had to
first
do.
At first, I thought it was part of the movie.
This issue.
and I had to go back and watch the first 5 minutes because I was like, oh, just in case there was a joke I wanted to hear, I need to see that again. Because, I mean, it was fairly easy to follow, but the subtitles were this weird German mix. That is so bizarre.
That
is
really strange.
You.
Yes, that happened to me too.
Okay, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk our book club stuff. Thank you for listening to our little endeavor. There are two ways you can help our podcast. One, go to our podcast app, go to your podcast app and rate and review us and submit. And two, if you have the desire and the means, we accept donations in lieu of advertising for the website hosting and podcast production. Just head over to buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake and you can donate any amount. Or if you go to the site, click on shop and you can find the link there. If you always wanted to write for the Alabama Take or make your own podcast, say no more. Actually, yes, do say more. And do so in the form of an email or a direct message. We'd love to hear your ideas. Let's get back into it because in our next segment, it's our first book club. So this is our first book club episode, and in full disclosure, it's the first book club I've ever been a part of, in truth. But Adam, you've got a lot of experience in this arena.
I did just recently here.
Honestly, I've heard of book clubs. What's the structure? What's the thought process that people do behind?
Well, every time that I've told someone that I've been in a book club, we could not have had better timing. It's with two other musicians, and we should have maybe met like six times since we started in March because everyone is kind of far flung and on tour and busy and stuff. But we started the week of the shutdown. We had read the first book. And so we meet outside around the fire and we've just kept plugging away and have just inhaled a bunch of books over the spring and summer and now the fall. But I'll say that first round when you sit down, well, like I had never discussed books with both these guys at the same time. Like how do you crack this egg here? How do you get going? Donovan, have you been in a book club like this?
Very informally. My I've seen a book club structure for just simple setting out, which is just say, you know, everyone has a chance, right? And say one thing you liked, one thing that stood out to you, and one question you have.
That's pretty good.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I like that. So just to get us going for our listeners, The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones is a 2020 work. It's a novel. And I guess it's a horror novel. Would you guys agree with that?
There were definitely some horrific scenes. I don't know. Sometimes when things, because it also felt very like folktale-y in a great way. So, but I mean, some scenes were pretty disturbing.
So, maybe a horror novel, though, not your classic ghost or haunted house or kind of thing, but we'll call it horror. And if I'm not mistaken, this author tends to write in that genre or has before.
He's a shockingly prolific guy.
Yes, he's written many books.
He's in his 40s and has like over 20 books published, something like that. So he churns them out.
So this is the first I'd heard of him, and we read The Only Good Indians, which is about... Donovan, you want to recap this?
As best I can. So it's about four friends, and you kind of... If you read it's one of those books where, right, if you read the dust jacket, you know that they're all connected. And if you actually read the book, you kind of piece it together. All of them, and the segments kind of go to different folks. And what was it, 10 years ago on the Saturday before Thanksgiving, they killed more elk than they could possibly take in a part of the land that they weren't supposed to be shooting on, where the elk was reserved for the elders. And then they felt like they had to, it kind of follows them that lived. One of them pretty quickly doesn't, in the great opening for this. That incident from 10 years ago is haunting them, whether they know it or one of them knows it, one of them doesn't, or two of them don't. kind of goes from there. It's pretty good.
So, yeah, what they've done in the past around Thanksgiving is coming back to get them, so to speak. All right. Well, let's do your setup, Donovan. I don't disagree with that. I like that. So give me one thing you guys liked, and we'll start with Adam.
I really enjoyed the way, as Donovan gave the narrative, the way that it was unveiled through the text was pretty fun. It didn't... You know that there's going to be four friends and that something is coming back to get them, so to speak. But the way that they're kind of thrown all around geographically and in time was the slow admittance of what they had done as well was good because it, you know, it clearly had haunted one of the characters, not physically yet, but it had bugged him and the others were unbothered. And I thought that the reveal of how large it loomed in their psychology and their subconscious was really well done. As far as questions, I thought that some of the... Did you guys feel that maybe some of the scary moments or mistaken identities were stretched a little too far?
That's a good question.
For instance, I guess we'll just get into spoiler land here. You know, wondering... Say when Nathan, the kid, wanders out and has happens to have been wearing the same practice jersey. Like, things like that kind of keep happening. Like, people come in at just the right moment. And, you have to expect some of that in this genre, for sure. But it just seemed to happen a lot.
Yeah, I noted it to be a little bit of leaning into, or not doing much with some horror tropes, which, to me, cropped up as... So-and-so's not dead yet. A very similar complaint where so-and-so is actually this person, and also so-and-so's not dead yet. So
Victor's last stand, Victor the cop.
Yeah, right. That was one where I was just like, come on. I let's just say he was dead. Let's just be done with that. But
I kind of liked it the most when it felt like there was something kind of spooky and supernatural going on around all that, as if... Which I guess maybe that was seated in my mind, because one of the things I was going to say I liked is how Lewis's story wrapped up with him both kind of being half right and being so, so terribly wrong at the same time.
Yeah, it all feels like a bad dream.
It does feel like a bad dream.
The kind where like you have done something and your dream starts kind of in the middle and you don't know what you've done, but like you're going to go to prison and your life is over. He seems totally in that. Lewis does. I thought his was, I mean, that was just nightmare material.
I guess I do remember, it's funny that you brought up the cop, Victor, because I also remember him, thinking like, oh man, really? Like how long has he been bleeding to death in that outhouse?
Hours.
And he's still good.
Hours,
so that
hours
was,
and hours.
But it wasn't something that like ruined the book for me or anything like that. You know, it was just like a little, yeah. And then, you know, I felt like he was doing something with that. Like it was always seemed like the wrong person at the wrong time, right? Like the wrong person is under the truck. The wrong person is walking up. The wrong person is, you know, doing X, Y, Z.
That was heavy in the sweat lodge section, but not, you know, he didn't do that a lot in other parts, which there might've been a inconsistency there.
Well, I thought he introduced it in the Lewis section where it's sometimes it's his real coworker. Yeah. Sometimes it's maybe not, you know, sometimes it's the Elkhead woman wearing a, you know, he's kind of planting the seeds of that sort of thing. I don't know.
Also didn't know how much of that was supposed to be supernatural. Like that, say in Lewis's section, that Shaney, the coworker, and PETA, the wife, die just back to back when they shouldn't have even been in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, is there some like black hole kind of thing going on where everyone is drawn to a certain moment at the same time?
That's very, here we go again, but that's very David Lynch, isn't it?
Yeah.
My favorite parts were when the author, when Stephen Graham Jones really dug into these human motifs of friendship and motherhood. And what a mother will do. And this is my favorite part. I'll just read it. It's because it's only one paragraph. This to me hit me more so than anything else in the book. It's laid in the book, and this is Gabe's daughter. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to escape death. And she's thinking about her dad who had just been killed by the elk monster woman thing. And she thinks, not because Gabe died, however he died, that's her dad, but because she never told anybody to let him stay when they were dragging him from the gym, because she pretended she didn't know him, because she was embarrassed, because she's still that girl standing on the bench seat of his truck beside him while he's driving, her hand on his shoulder, the cab full of his stories that were all true, she knows. And that, the juxtaposition of loving someone and being embarrassed by their bad side is so touching and moving, or was to me, and that's to me life. And I wanted more of that. I did not get enough of that. It was sprinkled throughout, and I know that if he did more, that would probably definitely veer it out of horror and into something else. But do you guys have a comment on any of that?
I thought maybe the most moving part of that paragraph to me, I mean, I definitely remember that specific passage. Mm-hmm. But you know, she's been embarrassed and doubting all of the stories all along, and they all have, and I'm definitely not an authority on what I'm about to say, but the complicated relationship with the myth of their identity as Blackfeet, and that, mm-hmm. you know, they all allude to the fact that when they're young, they're into it. And then they all age out of giving a shit about it at a certain point. Even the older guys kind of laugh about it. Nathan seems resentful that none of it holds water. Denora seems proud, but not specifically with her dad. She doesn't believe his escapades. She doesn't believe everything that he says he's done. But when she says, I believed all the stories were true, it seemed to be like a validation that he gets to be. She starts thinking of that confrontation as one of the stories that she had been told. Of good versus evil, and that seemed like a letting him have his place in that lineage of myth, I guess. And I don't know, I thought that was really good.
So do we want to go into some things we didn't like, though we've touched on them briefly? Is there something more specific that you wanted to say about what just wasn't working?
I'd like to jump in real quick with something that I did like.
Okay,
dude. My thing that stood out to me was I thought the beginning was just a really good, probably the first 12 pages was just a really good, almost encapsulation of what it was, what the book was going to be doing, where, you know, he's kind of killed by this ghostly or otherwise elk herd, but he's also killed by the very real racist violence, you know, coming up right behind him. And I just thought that just kind of raises, thinking back to it, raises the hairs on my arm. So I thought this one had a real good, it had a good start. And I think it made me want to see what else he's going to talk about.
Yeah. And it also set the tone for just the amount of brutality,
yeah,
I guess, that was coming. And you, that, not that that was like overly, when you know that you're going to read a horror book, that's not maybe unexpected, but then say the scene with the dog, when they find the dog the first time, you're like, oh, this is what's happening. And then Shaney getting her hair caught and blah, blah, blah. And all these things that I enjoyed the sections where the supernatural had not been defined yet. And it was just causing, the anxiety of it was causing bad things to happen more than the supernatural was doing it itself.
It was really,
which was the power of the first 12 pages, like you said.
It was really interesting too, how a lot of the early violence in Lewis's section, well, early and late violence, is kind of connected in some ways with Indianness. When the attire, you know, when he kills Shaney, he thinks about scalping. When the dog is hung up, you know, it's like a, he thinks about hunting and stuff. It was really kind of
caught in the snare.
Yeah, it was sad. I found it extremely sad.
Him processing it or processing everything that's happening and kind of going AWOL on his post office job too. All of a sudden, he adds an extra layer of guilt to everything else that he's not pulling his weight, and he knows he should be, but he's paralyzed by what's happening to him. And all of those subtle, again, this is not an area of expertise at all, but kind of that subtle, like him being afraid to slide into the stereotype of what he grew up with, like drinking the beer in bed, for instance, saying all these things that he's trying to avoid, and the background of even like they hunt where they hunt because they couldn't follow them onto the national park land, right? Like these little subtle strokes are all through that just highlight the shitty situation that they're in.
Yeah.
I will say that the problems I had with the book are twofold. I felt there was a bit of inconsistency, which I had mentioned briefly earlier. And there were, Donovan, you talked about that intro. I found that intro a bit hard to imagine or picture. The writing was...
Interesting. I found it very vivid for me.
Really?
I had a really easy time imagining the beginning. That's interesting that you had the opposite problem.
And some of those really action-packed scenes, such as the basketball scene between Denora and the ghost Shaney when she returns, I couldn't quite figure out what I was supposed to imagine in my head. That might be my fault as a reader, but I just don't. I think those needed touching.
I always have that trouble, honestly. Like when things are when there are bodies moving, and when I'm supposed to really be able to picture what two bodies are doing in a wink,
and my way
in a book, I often have trouble like really being able to, you know, like there was a bit where I think it's like the way Shaney jumps. I think she was supposed to be like dunking over her back, and then she falls into the pole and hurts herself. I have that trouble, not just with books like this, but with that's kind of cuts across books that I read. I'm just okay. I'll figure it out.
And I think that might be the case with me as well at times. So there's my complaints with the book, and we can go around with that.
Did you find that it was when things were inconsistent, it was more by the section? Or was it inconsistencies from, say, page to page, scene to scene, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it was definitely the sections. The sections held together nicely, but I wanted a little more cohesion from from each of those.
Meaning you wanted the sections to fit together better, not like pages within a section?
Right. That's correct.
Okay. I thought that the, you know, use the word inconsistent. I didn't think that the writing was super consistent at times. Like just the quality of, he clearly got revved up and cooking at times, but other times it was kind of like it felt, always hesitate to criticize someone who is a successful author and has, you know, a pretty swank job apparently at the University of Colorado. But it felt a little lazy at times. Like he was just getting from A to B.
I agree with that. That was part of the inconsistency for me.
Yeah. I wondered too if it's like a really prolific band or songwriter. Like this guy's written so much that, you know, there are great songs on every record, but is the whole record great? Usually not with bands like that. And I didn't know if I should take that the same way. Like the beginning of Lewis's section is one that to me was kind of, you know, it took a while to get going. And I don't mind that as like a horror trope or a scary trope that you have to establish a scene. And it did hit harder knowing some of his routine, but it also kind of felt, maybe some of the conventions felt a little trite, like his relationship with his coworkers, or even once they get on the reservation and they're kind of riding around, it didn't feel as good as it could have been.
I think I would agree with that. Like that's something I noticed. When he was on fire, man, he was on fire. That was one of the things I loved about, I know you didn't like it as much, Blaine, but I loved about those first 12 pages. Like I felt like it was all killer, you know, no filler. And there were some other bits that like I just raced through, usually when something gruesome was happening. And he had some great, like I really love authors that'll give you a great image. Like, and I feel like he more than pulled that off a lot. He's obviously, like Adam said, I hesitate to criticize. He's obviously good, right? Like he's good. This is a well-written book, but at times I felt like I was reading, like what kept popping into my head was like, I feel like I'm reading a Stephen King novel that I don't really like. Like I like Stephen King, but sometimes it's just like Stephen King writes too much. And he has a certain like style or rhythm that I just think he falls back into without thinking about it. And I wondered if that was a little bit of what was going here. You know, it's this kind of, and it's not bad. It's this kind of like, but it is that kind of like blue collar, half jokey, half serious kind of inner monologues that'll often be running through characters' heads. Stephen King does it a lot.
And also the idea of using of the monster or the ghost using a new body to, and unable to use the voice was very reminiscent of The Outsider, which I haven't read, but the show.
I haven't read that or seen the show. So I didn't think of that.
So let's jump into our last part, which would be questions. And here's mine. Why did he choose to shift into second person when referencing the elk mother ghost thing? What's the choice there? Why? Because it seemed jarring at first, and I'm not sure what results he wanted with that.
Is it supposed to make the Elkhead woman less of a monster? Less of an unknowable monster, I guess is what I mean.
Yeah, and maybe give a degree of remove to her actions. Like, she isn't a human body. She has a voice for a section. But at the same time, it seems to be some working of the natural world. You know, like it's almost just like this is happening because it's meant to happen. And the train is on the tracks, so to speak. And you're going through the motions. I don't know. It was always drunk because a lot of the sections, the chapters would end kind of pulling back. And you realize, oh, she's been observing this whole
thing. Yeah, it's usually framing the chapters, right? We're pulling back I was thinking snapback. So pulling back is exactly the way I was feeling. Where it kind of will usually in the last second revert to second person, and you'll remember it really was second person all along. I did kind of think that it was making the Elkhead woman not something that was just striking randomly out of the night, but I think it maybe was supposed to sort of tie in with the ending where, you know, like you have some sympathy or whatever for her. But that's a good, I usually don't care for the second person. And I didn't hate it here.
Yeah.
You know, almost sometimes the only way, you know, the only way to really answer this question is to read the book again and skip the parts with you and see if it's a different book. But it is kind of an interesting, I thought it was supposed to, like, you, because there's some sympathy engendered, right, with this character. Because in a lot of the you parts, it's about dying, and it's about the calf, and it's about what you will do for your child, right?
Any other questions left?
Did the ending work for you when it shifted to Denora? I'm not sure it 100% worked for me. It kind of felt wrapped up pretty quick.
Yeah, it wrapped up way more nicely than I thought it was going to. And I thought that kind of the death march across all of that land was stretched too far. Like, that went on a little bit longer than I wanted it to. And I don't know if that maybe is, I don't, maybe like a lack of, we're back to like kind of, he rushes to get characters from A to B. And I don't know if maybe it could have been stronger writing through that section or what, but yeah, it seemed to go on a little long and I thought that it was a little tidy.
I will say something that I did like about that is to kind of bouncing off of something Adam pointed out earlier was it does have that dreamlike quality of just like something is following you and it is not going to stop. So I think honestly, like some of his best stuff was, I think Adam nailed it on the head, right? It's got this kind of dream or nightmare quality to it. Some of the scariest parts.
Noting that she walks in a straight line for the majority of that, just kind of, just creepy stuff like that. Like, she thinks she has a big, Denora thinks she has a big lead and turns around and the
and it's really right there. Yeah.
All right. Final thoughts on the book.
Is this where we, you know, do the old Ebert and Roper thumbs up, thumbs down?
You sure can.
I'll thumbs up this one. I don't regret reading it. It was good. It made me think. There were some good bits in it.
I give it a, if I was going to rate it on Goodreads, which I will, I'll give it a probably a 3 out of 5 stars. I thought it moments were very good. Like we haven't even talked about the Sweat Lodge debacle. When things really go downhill there, I thought that's what you want when you pick up a book that was, we timed this for Halloween week. That's kind of where you think it's going to go. And it did. And all of that was really good outside of, you know, we talked about them mistakenly shooting the kid, Nathan, and their mistaken identity there, and then Victor coming back to life. All of that was a little messy, but it was still a fun scene. Yeah, I thought it was good. And I thought sometimes I'll recoil from, I feel like a lot of literature now wants to live in the grime, you know, even if it's just of the either like grit lit kind of Southern stuff, or like in Lewis's section, just kind of this, well, they have another rental house and life is kind of hard and kind of boring. People really love living in that world now, and I'm kind of tired of reading about it. That would be my only hesitation, but framing it through the experience of the American Indian in the 21st century, I think, undercut that and made it powerful again.
Also, I think it was something that I appreciated because I completely agree with you, Adam. You know, it's kind of like you got all those Tarantino knockoffs in the 90s. They're like, this is how life really is, you know, and it's like, whatever.
Right.
But it didn't feel like an exercise, like the characters didn't necessarily feel like an exercise in misery, which maybe made what happened to them sadder. But it was kind of, and I maybe part of that, I think, was, you know, I guess part of what I appreciated about it is, you know, sometimes when in these grit lit things, when someone actually finally dies, you're like, they might be better off dead because clearly the author is just torturing them, right? It's like, you know, but these guys, it seemed like there was a glimpse of like, but for this thing, like they could have had like good lives and good lives on a little bit of their terms and a little bit of someone else's terms. And I thought that was kind of a good, I liked that it wasn't, you know, sometimes you read something that's, everyone's just a monster in it, and you're like, well, everyone got what they deserve, so I don't know what we're supposed to learn from this.
Part of the grittiness I'm not supposed to be comfortable with, because this is a an Indian writing about the experience on the reservation, you know? And there were moments like when Denora is kind of fantasizing about her image being on a poster, you know, like in the America that they take back, like those kind of things. And then explaining to the kids in the future that, you know, there was a time when we didn't have our land, like that kind of, there were very brief glimpses of maybe a bigger social narrative. And him just kind of injecting those, you left, other things were a little bit more explained and a little bit more plot A to B, like I complained about, but his ability to give you a vibe on that instead of spoon feeding you, I thought that was pretty good.
I think I have rated this on Goodreads already, and it was a 3 out of 5 for sure for me. And
I think that would be about mine too.
It felt like a radio signal. It would come in and out for me. There were great parts that really resonated, and then there were parts where I couldn't get the signal. All right, so that's our thoughts. That's it for this week. As always, it's appreciated that you've listened. Leave us a review. Why don't you? We'll have a new episode out next week, Election Day. And what's more appropriate for next week than a talk about David Byrne and his HBO special, American Utopia? We'll cover it and some of our favorite shows, movies, songs, and books from political pop culture. We'll have a short list of ideas of our favorite politics and pop culture. We will talk to you all then.